Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP, lawn and garden, and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money at Menards.
Leftover Crack are a band of drug-abusing, dumpster-diving, cop-hating, queer-positive, pro-choice crust punks. So begins the inside sleeve of Architects of Self-Destruction, the new oral history of Leftover Crack. This book documents the band's tumultuous career in a surprisingly honest and sometimes unflattering way. The authors of this book, who join us on this episode, are John Gentile and Brad Logan. John is a longtime contributor to Punk News, and Brad has played guitar in Leftover Crack for the majority of their existence. Together, they've strung together a compelling story in the words of the people that lived it that may make you like the band more or may make you hate them. Either way, it will definitely give you a sense of who they actually are.
What do you like better, Leftover Crack or Choking Victim?
Probably Choking Victim.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. And I think a big part of that is that for me, when Leftover Crack really was taking off was kind of when ska punk had fallen out of favor. And so they were pushed even further onto the periphery.
Yeah, and Choking Victim too, they sort of like came and went so fast. They just kind of played a few shows, put out that record, broke up, and they were gone.
Right. And so all you had to judge them by was just the songs on that recording. Which, you know, I feel like people feel all sorts of different ways about Leftover Crack now and Choking Victim now. But I feel like this book, from what I've read of it, I'm about 200 pages in. I feel like it gives a pretty even-handed, sometimes frightening view of the band.
It's not a fluff piece, and it's not like, you know, it doesn't attack the band. It just sort of portrays them in an honest way, as they all say. And oftentimes the members contradict each other. So you're getting all these different stories, but I kind of feel like that's what a good oral history should do.
Definitely. I like that it shows all those different perspectives.
All right. So I just want to start. We want to talk about Scott Sturgeon right away. I interviewed him in like 2018 or something. And so I know that there's lots of Scott stories and stuff, but like, was it last year or the year before? I can't remember. He had posted on Facebook on the Leftover Crack thing about, you know, his exes and people that like definitely got people upset him in a way that was beyond what I think even the past, you know, where it was viewed as him threatening violence on his exes. I'm not sure exactly what your guys' take on all that is, but just in general, I think like it's a very polarizing thing to talk about him and therefore, you know, Leftover Crack. So I just want to kind of discuss that right up front. And what your guys' take are, since you guys, you know, Brad, you're in his band and you're in a band together, and John, and you know, you helped co-write this book.
It's a very sensitive subject, and we're aware it's a very sensitive subject, and we address it in the book. We talk to the people involved in those scenarios, the people that wanted to talk about it, and we put their commentary in the book. And I can't really speak on behalf of them. You know, those are complex things. And so the people have their say, and Sturgeon has his say, and we can't really speak on behalf of those people because that's unfair to do.
I mean, do you want to ask a more direct question in regards to it? Because, you know, what was he thinking when he wrote that? I do not know. You know, we live in, I have my opinions about it, right? But we live on opposite sides of the U.S. and I see him in person very little, you know, really only when we play.
Well, I mean, listen. Sturgeon is a very polarizing person. He's very intelligent, and sometimes he says a lot of crazy and stupid stuff. Sturgeon has been quite open that he has mental health issues and other issues as well. And when people have mental health issues and other issues, they say weird, crazy stuff. You know what I mean? Is it a nice thing to say or a good thing to say? No, you know. But, you know, when you have people that live on the edge in their art, like Sturgeon does, they're going to say weird stuff sometimes. Lou Reed said weird stuff, you know. David Bowie said weird stuff. And does it make it right or okay? No. But, I mean, like I said, everyone has their say in the book. And it's not for us to say another person's experience is right or wrong, you know, especially in this book, which I'd argue is a very objective view of Leftover Crack. It talks about the good and the bad side. So I mean, what's the question exactly?
I guess I'll be a little more direct. I felt, so I interviewed him before that happened. And then by the time the book was finalized and ready to go in, it had happened. And I had seriously considered, like, you know, maybe taking him out of the book because of it. Well, how do you address it in the book?
We talk to people that are involved in the circumstance that you're referring to, the people that wanted to talk to us, and we print what they say. And I can't really comment on what they say from my perspective, you know.
The stock answer is, you know, it's in the book, you know what I mean? And we address certain, you know, topics like that where we're talking to people that there has been, that he's had conflicts with, you know, and we talk to both parties, right? You know, well, here's him talking about it. Here's here they are talking about it. Here are a number of people in the given situation weighing in on it, you know, and let the reader make up their own mind. As for me personally, you know, in my personal life, I'm not really a guitar player. I'm a guy who works with, you know, people that are in trouble, you know, and so. You know what I mean? And, you know, having, you know, had, you know, been through the ringer with, you know, substance abuse and mental issues myself, you know, when I was younger. And so the world I come from, you know, is filled with people that are suffering greatly, you know, and, you know, it's a world of people wanting to fucking kill themselves, you know, that are trapped in these, mental situations that they can't get out of, you know, and they're looking for help. You know, some of them aren't looking for help. I never talked to him directly about that, but I've seen that kind of stuff. It's commonplace, you know, when you're working with people that need help, you know, it just is. So to me, you know, it I'm not condoning it, but it wasn't shocking. It's like, you know, given certain situations, it just isn't shocking, you know.
My experience with them, and it's in your book, is that he stole food from a grocery store while we were interviewing him, which is kind of, I feel like, falls into the category of funny.
While you were interviewing him, he was shoplifting.
Yeah, that's like, you know, a person that's, you know, like you said, lives on the edge and all that stuff. It's something that's funny. It's not really offensive to me personally. Is there lines with him and his behavior in terms of like your participation of him with him in a band or people's support of the band? I think that's some of the question.
Well, I mean, what's the question? What are the lines of acceptable behavior?
Yeah, I mean, and how do you navigate that? I mean,
what are the lines of acceptable behavior to participate in a band with somebody who would do that? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm just kind of exploring that idea.
Sure. Well, my personal take is, I mean, I've known Sturgeon. I won't call him Scott. I've known Sturgeon a long. I've known Sturgeon a long time. I've known him since he was a little kid, you know, and you know, I mean, I just don't think he's, you know, capable of being that kind of guy. You know, he's not a violent dude. He's just not. He's a fucking powder puff, you know? And so, you know, of course, what people post on social media and how they want to portray themselves are more often than not two different things, you know? And so, you know, I don't know what his take on writing that particular post you're talking about was. You know, there was a whole period of just, you know, these, like, you know, just one after another of like what's going on here? You know, post after post, you know, which are consistent to me, you know, with somebody who's like suffering, you know. So is he capable of that kind of stuff? No, I don't think so. You know, I mean, not where I come from. You know, I know some truly dangerous people, and you know, growing up in the places that I grew up, and he's not that kind of guy. He's just fucking not. You know, I mean, he's got problems, but he's not that guy. So, you know, why would I want to continue to participate? Well, I'm, you know, Punk Bowling is going to be my last show with the band.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm leaving to pursue other things, you know. It's a combination of reasons I'm leaving, but mostly because I want to do other things, you know. And, you know, I'm a guy that likes to live, like, you know, just a quiet life. You know what I mean?
How many people have been in and out of Leftover Crack?
I would say probably as many people as were in if you go down the list of people that were in Mothers of Invention. No, I don't know. I mean, fucking, you know, it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, there are people that have been in the band that I don't remember their names. You know, they played a couple of shows. They were cool to hang out with. I don't remember the names. You know, they were in and out so fast, you know, and so I couldn't give you a number. You know, it's been primarily the same people. Do I like that kind of situation? Lots of band members? No, I don't like that kind of situation personally. To me, I consider a band to be a very sacred thing in a unit, you know, and the integrity should be preserved of the people that are, you know, making the records. You know, it's not just, it doesn't matter if one person is writing all the music. You know, there's more to a band than one person writing all the music. There are a lot of elements in it. Everybody brings their own unique abilities and takes on things. And that's part of, you know, the beautiful thing about collaborating with other people on artwork, you know, or music or whatever. I mean, are these things you can do by yourself? Sure. You know, painters paint by themselves. You know, my wife is a painter. She doesn't work with anybody. She loves that. You know, I like collaborating with other people because oftentimes, you know, you'll come up with things that are way better than you could come up with by yourself, you know, just throwing the ideas around. Or at least different, you know, and different is good. So, you know, I don't like that kind of stuff. No. And my personal bands that I've been in, you know, within reason, you know, if one person leaves or, you know, I was in a band for a while that had like a Spinal Tap drummer kind of situation going, you know, and our drummers are just exploding. And, you know, F Minus was like that. And that was kind of the thing for a while. Well, okay, you know, whoever can play drums, you know. But once we locked in, you know, the guy who did all of our Hellcat records with us, that was it, you know. And then, you know, once that sort of core lineup started to break up, I just had no desire to continue doing it, you know. Even though I had more ideas and more things that I felt we could have pursued, it just, you know. It starts to dilute.
Right. In reading a lot of the Leftover Crack book, it feels like a lot of the membership of the band is very fluid and tenuous, where, you know, people are getting kicked out or quitting kind of left and right, which is what made me bring up the, you know, how many people have been in and out. I was trying to get a gauge of like how many people stick around versus how many people kind of come and go, just getting kind of a better picture of that.
Yeah. How many people have been in the band in a significant capacity, like for an extended period of time?
I have no idea. You know, I mean, the reasons that people didn't stick around were because, you know, they had jobs or whatever, and they, you know, they couldn't tour year round, you know? And, it wasn't because, you know, some of them thought, ah, oh, you guys are fucking a bunch of assholes, you know, and we never held that against anybody. You're right. We're a bunch of fucking assholes, you know, but no,
I'm gonna jump in and that Brad is not in that. Brad is actually one of the several nice people in the band, as is Aura. I will say one of the conflicts in the band is between Sturgeon and Ezra, and the reason for that conflict is because they're both extremely talented. They're both extremely, extremely smart. Well, a lot of people don't even know. Like, Ezra can fly airplanes. Like, he's licensed to fly airplanes.
He can fly.
He's a yoga master. Yeah. He knows how to build he built a house, you know. So Ezra, I mean, and Sturgeon, we talk about in the book, is Sturgeon got into Bronx Science without even trying. If the listeners don't know, Bronx Science is like the Harvard of high schools. Like, it's free, it's public, but you have to like pass an extremely hard test to get into, you know. And Sturgeon just went, Sturgeon partied the night before, went and got into Bronx, and then decided not to go because it was too far of a bus ride, you know. And so one of the conflicts you have is you've got these two artistic powerhouses, and Brad is often caught in the middle, as is Aura. And frankly, Aura leaves the band, Aura the drummer, because he's kind of a normal guy. He's got a family and he just can't live in this chaos, you know.
You know, I mean, I joined the band as just a utility guy, right? A guitar player, you know. I had no stake in the songwriting. You know, I had my own band. You know, I had my own things that I did. And I'd known Sturgeon through, you know, it talks about it in the book, right? I knew him through working at Hellcat and you know, sort of, you know, digging those gut, choking victim up, you know, and it was like, hey, you want to play guitar? I have all these songs and I need somebody to play guitar. And it's like, sure. You know, these songs are great. This sounds fun. You know, totally different than anything that I would write, you know? So in a sense, you know, I never felt like it was my band, you know, in that sense. But yeah, I mean, you know, everybody that's played with us has been great in their own right. Even the people that were in there for 2 days that whose names I can't remember. I'm not trying to shit on anybody, you know, and that's the only reason I can't remember their names is because, you know, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, you know, and you know, it's like, you know, everybody has been, you know, either a great player or if they weren't a good player, they were an awesome person, you know, and that's very important too. I'm not the greatest player, you know. I have like a thing that I do, and that's what I do, you know. You know, I think the one thing that everybody who's been in the band had in common was we, you know, we all had the same sort of goals. You know, I don't really want to use the word politically, but, you know, we were all for pushing for, you know, a better world of equal rights and you know, love, really, you know, and acceptance of you know, people, no matter what their, you know, sexual orientation, you know, racial background, gender, any of that sort of stuff. And those are the things that the band was pushing for. And that's what I was attracted to in the beginning. You know, I mean, we're not the first band to do that. We're another in a long line of bands all pushing for that kind of world, you know, that's been going since, you know, the 50s and 60s, right? But, you know, I think that needs to still continue to be, you know, I think that the thing Leftover Crack did was, you know, we brought it out of the you know, the DIY basement into more of a mainstream sort of situation. If I can even use that term in regards to the band, but, you know, we were playing like, you know, we'd play anything from literally somebody's fucking living room, you know, to, you know, festivals to whatever, you know, and always pushing that agenda, I guess, you know, that was our agenda.
One of the themes I felt was covered in the book was this idea that Leftover Crack was viewed by some people or a lot of people outside of the sphere as being shock value, just being about shock value and having and that sort of discussion about whether you guys were serious about your message, or if you had a message, or if you were just trying to shock people. What is your take on that?
When I met Sturgeon, he was 20 years old, and he was the most PC person I had ever met, ever, you know, and straight out of, you know, straight out of ABC No Rio, you know, and just like unflinchingly serious about the topics that he was writing about, you know, but also sprinkled in with songs about mental illness, you know, and wanting to off yourself, you know, and not being able to come to grips with this world that we're thrown into, and having it drive you fucking insane, you know. But he used, I think, a lot of imagery just for the fun of it, you know what I mean? A lot of, you know, dark imagery and I think people miss the humor in it as well, you know, and I don't know if I don't know. None of that stuff was shocking to me. Oh, a pentagram, you know, none of that stuff was shocking to me ever, you know, but that's me. And, you know, if you're referring to shocking, like, you know, album art or flyer art, or do you mean it as far as, you know, some of the antics at gigs?
I would say that, like, some people, you know, the album art, the satanic imagery, I think the extremity of some of the lyrics, maybe people were like, are they being serious? Do they really mean kill cops? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The debate about if it was a shock value band or a political band, I think, well, I definitely got that from the book, that was something like a dynamic happening.
I mean, you would have to ask Sturgeon about the lyrics, really, to you know, to me, I never took kill cops literally, but that's me, you know, and because we don't want to fucking kill people. You know, the thing was, you know, going to that extreme to drive home a point, you know, against police brutality, right? And that's what it was, you know.
He told me that it was, he went there because Ice-T made the Cop Killer song and then backed down, got so much pressure and backed down that he thought it was fucked up that he would have to back down from that message. So he felt inclined to push that message.
Well, I mean, if you look at, from a fan's perspective, that's why Leftover Crack is a super interesting band. Is when they have songs like Kill Cops, you know, Shoot the Kids at School, are they being serious or is it art? And that it is art. And the point isn't this is exactly what I think and this is what everyone else should think. The point is, here's a concept and you should contemplate the concept. The fact is police do create injustice. The fact is school violence, which is bad and is not good, is often perpetrated by kids that have terrible home life or are picked on at school and both. So you can write a doctoral thesis on why there's violence at school or why police abuse their power, you know, but is that going to catch young people's attention like a song like, you know, Kill Cops would? You know, and the answer is no. And so it plants that vague idea that doesn't even really have a specific concrete meaning or definition, and it gets the young people to think critically and think, well, what does this mean? What do I think? And that's, I mean, that's art. I mean, you know, that's all the best art there is. Yes. You know, I mean, if we look at, you know, Clash, I'm So Bored with the USA, is Joe Strummer really saying he hates the USA? No, he's putting out this abstract concept which you can bend at your will, you know.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you know, what would Ian MacKaye say? You know, think, use your head. You know, and is it really, you know, do we really think school shootings are fucking awesome? You know, and you know, capping people is, maybe he did if he was talking about the Ice-T thing. You know, I don't know. I had never, you know, been privy to any sort of attitudes of like, you know, anybody getting killed was awesome, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I'm not sure if this is exactly what his point was, but it seems to me like the idea of saying kill cops is like the most ultimate taboo you can say that, you know, and that's kind of the point, is that why is killing a cop even more taboo than saying kill your next door neighbor? Like, why?
It is. I mean, it's extreme politics, and it's the Panthers were doing that, you know, doing that stuff in the 60s, and they used, you know, harsh rhetoric, man, to get the point across, and actions, you know, but, you know, again, I mean, you know, I got to be careful commenting about the lyrics because, you know, I didn't write the lyrics. So it's, you know, speculation really on my part.
I want to talk a little bit about both of you guys. You guys wrote this book together. So I want to know a little bit about what your guys' history and relationship is and how you guys wrote a book together and what sort of your roles were with it.
I have no idea where I met John. Who is this guy? I don't even know. Some straight edge guy from Treme, you know.
I knew Brad Logan from F. I mean, I didn't know him. I knew F. Minus on Leftover Crack, and I was a big fan, so I interviewed him for Punk News. This is maybe 10 years ago or more. The funny thing was, is I'm interviewing him, and I knew that Brad loved Blue Oyster Cult. So I start the interview with like 6 questions about Blue Oyster Cult, and about like the 6th question, Brad says to me, he says, "Listen, I don't really know that much about Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, I like their logo." And I realized that Felix Havoc loves Blue Oyster Cult, not Brad Logan. And so Brad thought I was a total psycho. And then we became pals since then.
Yeah.
And then Brad called me up on the phone about 4 years ago. And he says, "Let's do a book on Leftover Crack." And I said, "I'm in." And then we did it. And so our roles were somewhat flexible, but basically both Brad and I did interviews with people. Brad interviewed people that might be more guarded because they were more relaxed with him, and Brad is an amazing interviewer. I mean, so much of interviewing is just charisma. Brad will say, "Hey, man, it looks like it's raining," and the person will be like, "Yeah, it's raining. It reminds me how I always hated my mother." You know what I mean? Like amazing, like, things. And so we would both do interviews. We would transcribe. Then I would take the transcriptions and what I call weave them together, you know, take bits that fit together and snap them together. And then Brad and I would go over the whole thing and clean it up and pinch stuff, add stuff, and take stuff out.
Brad, you had thought like, oh, you know, it's time to document this band. I'm curious, what was the thought process there?
Right. It, you know, so many insane thing, you know, just, you know, contradictions and just, you know, I've been watching bands literally all my life, right? I started going to concerts when I was 10, and just so many crazy things were happening in the context of this band. It, you know, not all bad things, right? Good things too. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh man, you know, I'd always say in the van while we're, you know, driving from show to show, somebody should really, you know, document this stuff. It's just too fucking insane, you know? And we would all laugh. Ha ha ha. And then I thought, well, you know, if nobody's going to do this, I'm going to do it, you know? And I contacted John because, I knew it was too much for one person to handle, you know, just the volume of people, that were involved, you know, but also John was a journalist and a writer and actually knew what he was doing. And I, you know, and I don't, right? And I wanted to work with somebody who had those credentials, you know, that could help hammer this thing into shape. And John's that kind of guy, you know, his work ethic and his writing you know, to me, he's, you know, he's a professional, you know, but,
thanks, Brad.
You know, I mean that, you know, and, but you also like, you know, just weirdo music and stuff, you know, I asked a couple of other people before I asked John and they were just like, "Oh yeah, sounds like a great idea." Then, you know, they would just fade away or disappear.
I didn't know that, but thanks for, you know, letting me be the last girl asked the prom. I didn't know that.
You actually showed up and were like, "Yeah, let's fucking do this. Here we go."
Well, you know, this changed my whole perspective now. I thought I was number one. Now I'm number 9.
Yeah, how does it feel, John, to be number 9?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I asked a couple of people, you know, I asked this guy in a 7-Eleven, and then I asked another dude down at, you know, the mechanic, you know, I asked a few other people, and it occurred to me that I need to work with somebody who has their shit together, you know.
Damage control.
Pedaling backwards, you know, and I mean, John had his shit together, you know.
That's it. The book's not coming out. I'm canceling it right now.
I quit. take out all my parts, take out all my interviews. So, granted, we couldn't put everything in this book that, you know, this is only a small slice, right? It's just you can't really encompass a, 15-year period in 300 pages, right? So we tried to put in, stuff that we thought was, that would be a good read, man, and interesting,
It's definitely compelling.
Did you read the whole thing? I think, it starts off one way and then it kind of goes into another thing and it ends, another way, right? It's like, it's a slow burn.
I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing yet. I've read about a third of it.
I started it today and I'm halfway through. So fuck you, Aaron.
Well, I have,
Good job, Adam. I appreciate that.
Adam's just a dad though. Come on.
What do you mean just a dad? Being a dad is a very important job. Dads and moms are arguably the most. Adam, how dare you let him like talk bad about like your contribution to this world?
It's okay. We'll edit that part out.
Because, I've given it to some people to read and they were like, they started reading and they're like, this is fucking bullshit. And I'm like, no, you got to keep reading, And they're like, all right.
I felt it was immediately compelling. The storytelling, it just moves along really fast. And it's just it definitely feels like chapter, like, how is this real? Like, how does this band last for 15 years?
That's the question. Yeah, I mean, really,
just the things, the circumstances and the decisions, it just feels like, yeah.
That was something I wanted to pick your guys' brains on because, the beginning of the book starts with choking victim and then leftover crack kind of coalescing out of just like, I mean, both bands are just basically train wrecks from the way that you guys lay it out. And I wanted to see what in your opinion caused these bands to persevere and not just have the labels just like drop them immediately or have people just slam doors in their faces. Like how did this happen?
I particularly felt like absolutely could not understand why Hellcat still put out that Choking Victim record.
Here's why. It's because the Choking Victim record is one of the greatest modern punk records ever. The Leftover Crack, all three Leftover Crack records are amazing. It's a very rarefied band that has these extremely serious concepts with such a wry sense of humor and grand ideas, And in that, I mean, honestly, like, if this band wasn't as, self-destructive as they are, you probably wouldn't have such artistic greatness. That's kind of the duality, which we've seen in other acts. We've seen that in The Replacements. We've seen that in The Stooges. And not that I'm saying Leftover Crack is as good as The Replacements or as good as The Stooges, but I'm saying that same kind of internal mania, which causes greatness, also causes great conflict. Look, Sturgeon, amazing artist, extremely far out guy. Ezra, amazing artist, extremely far out guy. Brad Logan, amazing artist, not as far out, and that's why he kind of anchors them down and brings up the straight up hardcore angle. You've got ska, which we should talk about more on this podcast. You've got metal, you've got hardcore, you've got punk. You've got all of these things being mixed together in a very convincing, genuine, bona fide way. They're not trying to be cute. They're being funny sometimes, but they're finding the connections between all these different things and being serious and also being funny at the same time. And that's why every time there's, every time it breaks down, it reassembles. After the breakdown of the second album, no one thought there was going to be a third Leftover Crack record. But the band after, I think it was 11 years or something, came out with Constructs of the State, an amazing record. The third record should not have been a great record. Most third records after 11 years are terrible records. The third Leftover Crack record is a great record. And it's because the band is full of extremely talented people, which because of their talent is maybe some of the reasons why they are such unusual people.
Well, so, I mean, would you say, I mean, I know you were trying to spin it in a positive way, but would you say that because the music's so good, people were like, okay, I'll work with these guys. If the music was maybe a little less good, people would be like, get these guys out of here.
That's exactly what I'm saying, 100%.
Yeah, okay. Now, Brad, give us the real answer. We heard the PR answer.
What John said. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I don't really have that you know, that perspective of being outside, you know, I think that, you know, why people would want to work with the band, you know, I mean, I think that, I don't know why people would want to work with the band. I know that the people in the band, you know, none of us had anywhere else to go. We were just, you know, in that we were, you know, musicians, artists, songwriters, creators. I use those terms loosely, you know, but that's like, you know, that's, there was no like, okay, well, if this doesn't work out, you know, I'm going to, you know, collect that trust or go get that job or, you know, put this degree to work. You know, everybody came from, you know, out of the shit, really. And so it was like, you know, there's nowhere else to go but to do this. And I think that the songs are pretty good. Yeah, it's like, yeah, this is, you know, it's on paper, it shouldn't work. You know, like when John was saying, you know, metal mixed with ska mixed with hardcore, that sounds like fucking dog shit, you know? Right. Like if somebody sent you a press release like that, you'd be like, cool, into the shredder, you know? And yet it works, you know, or at least for me, it did. You know, it didn't sound like a ska band. It didn't sound like a metal band. You know, it didn't sound like any of those things. It was its own thing, which was, you know, pretty cool. You know, when you kind of hit your own, you know, your own vein, so you know, speaking from the, you know, the band member side, nobody had anywhere better to go. You know, there was no fucking retirement plan. You know, there still isn't. You know, so, you know, the band was going to make records regardless if anybody wanted to put it out or not.
I think the thing that's weird,
the thing about the Choking Victim record, I will say to sorry to cut you off, is that, you know, when the band exploded, I remember, you know, going back to Tim and going, well, this band just fucking melted down. And he's like, that's cool. I'm going to put this record out anyways, because I really like this record and I really like that band. And Operation Ivy broke up after their record came out, you know, and that record came out anyways. So this record's going to come out anyways. And I don't care if I lose money, you know, I just don't give a shit, you know, I'm putting this record out. And Tim was in it, you know, for the music and for the bands, you know, he was very passionate about that. And, you know, that was like, you know, just mind blowing to me, like, oh, that's so great that you're going to put this out. Cause it is a really good record, you know? And I think it ended up doing pretty good for Hellcat or whatever, but you know, that wasn't even the thinking, well, you know, what about recouping this money or, you know, none of that stuff mattered. And, I thought that was just, you know, really cool of Tim to do that.
So Choking Victim breaks up 2 days into the recording, and you're kind of there as like a liaison or something. And how does Tim Armstrong, how does he react to the news that Choking Victim is no more as they're recording the album?
Yeah, I had been assigned the task by Hellcat, by Tim, really, not by Hellcat, by Tim, to go dig up this. He was like, I'm starting this label. You know, there's a bunch of bands I want to sign. There are too many bands that I want to sign. And, you know, I was working at Hellcat kind of part-time and in between Rancid tours. You know, I was living down the street from Epitaph, and he's all, okay, here's a job for you. You know, go find this band Choking Victim, in, you know, the Lower East Side. And you know, here's a phone number on a piece of paper and a plane ticket to New York City. I was like, sounds good. So, you know, I called the number, which, you know, this was before cell phones, this is before texting, this is before, you know, any sort of real functional email. You know, I called the number, that Tim had given me, and it was, you know, it was like Sturgeon's mom or something. You know, I left a message, and you know, so Sturgeon called me back a few days later before I left LA, and I was like, all right, meet me in front of Coney Island High at 3 o'clock on this date, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right. And so, you know, I get into New York City and, it, you know, 3 o'clock on Wednesday, the 16th or whatever the fuck it was, you know, I'm walking down, Coney Island High was this club on, St. Mark's, right there kind of by, where, Destroy is now. I don't even know if Destroy is still there, but you know, there's this kid sitting out in front, man. And he looked exactly like he sounded on the recording of, 500 Channels, right? It's like, I'd never met the guy. I didn't know what he looked like, but when I saw him, you know, just all in black, you know, just dirty as hell, dreads, you know, young, you know, he's like 19 or 20. It's like, this is the guy, you know, it has to be the guy. And basically I went to, you know, I went to the band and went, you know, I work for this label Hellcat. It's, you know, Tim from Rancid does it. And, you know, he wants to do the record with you guys. And, you know, they were very apprehensive, you know, they weren't like, sure, let's do it. They were like, I don't know. You know, this is like, sounds like some corporate bullshit. And you know, we don't know who you people are. And, you know, I went there to convince them that Hellcat was run by real people that cared about music, you know, and which it was, you know, and, you know, it was Tim, it was the Wicks, it was, you know, all the staff there at the time were just music fans. You know what I mean? These weren't like people with, you know, masters in business and marketing. And, you know, there may have been a few, you know, one or two of those type of people, but by and large, the staff of Epitaph and Hellcat was just fucking, you know, music fans, you know, record store people. And so they agreed to do it. And, you know, I think they came out to LA and, you know, met the, you know, the Epitaph staff. So the recording was set. Here's the date. We don't want to do it in a studio. We don't want anybody to produce it. We want to do it ourselves at Serenity Squad, which was where Squirt lived across the, it was, you know, next block over from C Squad. We're going to do it in Squirt's house. So I go out there with this guy named Mike Trujillo, who, was on the Epitaph staff. And, you know, I forget what he did, you know, he did some bullshit, but he was also like he had a recording studio in his garage, man. And I don't know if he had ever recorded records or anything before, but he had a bunch of like outboard recording gear, you know, just all in one rack. So we went out to New York City together. We went up the day before, we, you know, set up the mics and everything in Squirt's house and kind of got it, you know, all the placement of everything and everything ready to go, you know, cool, this is going to be great. And I think that, I don't remember where I was, you know, I was probably running around New York City, but you know, that's like a second home to me. I had a bunch of friends out there and I was probably running around with people, but you know, and I just wanted to leave the band alone. What the fuck am I going to do? Right. So I left them alone, you know, to make the record. You know, I went in to check in with them, you know, the second day of recording after getting some basic tracks and, you know, I come walking up the street and, you know, there's Shane and Squirt and Ezra all standing in front of C Squad, you know, like kind of looking at the ground, you know, standing around this like, you know, tree out there. I'm like, hey, you know, how'd it go yesterday? You know, this is fucking exciting. Cool. We're going to do this. And they're like, Squirt just punched Sturgeon out. They just got in a big fight. And I was like, what? What are you telling me? I'd never even heard of anybody doing that kind of stuff, right? What do you mean you got in a fight? Well, cool. Let's just get in there and, you know, make that fucking record. And they were like, no, I think Sturgeon, you know, doesn't want to do the record now. He's over in Tompkins Square Park, I think. And I was like, this is just madness. So, I walked over to Tompkins. It was madness, and yet it wasn't madness. You know, coming from the LA punk scene, the scene that I came from, it was like, you know, people being crazy like this was how people were, you know. But you didn't do the shit when you were making a fucking record, right? For this, like, you know, big record label. It's like, this is insane. And I went into, I found him in Tompkins laying on a bench, you know, you know, he looked like he'd been bludgeoned about the head and shoulders, you know, and just bloodied. And I'm like, dude, what's up? You know, you look great. Are we going to go in and make this record? You know, and he's all, no, you know, I don't want to like see those guys. I don't want to do this record. Sorry. You know, I'm done. I'm not doing it. So I went back and I told those guys, nope, he's not doing it. And so we decided to wait, you know, like, well, let's see, let everybody cool off and we'll see, you know, what it's like tomorrow. You know, Sturgeon was just pretty adamant about it. He was pretty hurt, I think, you know, you know, I went back to LA I probably called Tim, you know, I don't remember exactly, but I probably called him and I went, hey, you know, here's what went down. You know, somebody got punched, record's not happening. He's like, what? What are you telling me? I'm like, no, real, you know, for real. So, you know, a couple of weeks went by and I think they tried to convince the band to, you know, continue on as a band. But they weren't, you know, Sturgeon wouldn't do that, but he agreed to finish the record. So, Squirt, Ezra and Shane did all the instrumental tracks at Serenity, you know, which was in Squirt's living room. And then Sturgeon did all his vocals and guitar at like another studio, I think out in LA somewhere. And I remember asking Tim, so, you know, what do you think about all this stuff? He's like, well, you know, I'm going to put the record out anyways, you know, even if they're broken up, even if they're not going to be a band, you know, Operation Ivy recorded a record. We put it out. We broke up, you know, the same day as we put out our record. If it's good enough for us, it's good enough for these guys. And I really like this record. And so I'm putting it out, you know, and I don't care if anybody fucking buys it. You know, I like the record and that's that. And that's what he did, you know, I was blown away. I was like, you know, that's just so awesome of you to do that, you know?
Do you recall, was there any, aside from like, you know, in the middle of it, was there thoughts that, oh, they're going to get back together? Or was it just like an acceptance of, okay, this band is done, but we really just want to do this record?
I always thought they'd get back together, right? You know, personally, that's what I thought. But it never happened, you know, which is a shame because I had seen them, you know, they only played a handful of shows in their existence, you know, prior to doing that record. And I saw a couple of them. I saw them a few times as a three piece, but that lineup that they had for No Gods, No Managers, you know, with Ezra on guitar, Shane, Squirt, Ezra, and Sturgeon. It was great, man. It was really good. You know, they were kind of on fire as a band, and it's just too bad it didn't continue. But you know, it's like, you know, maybe that's the way it needed to play out. You know, maybe that's what needed to happen. You know, and if they had been, you know, I kind of, you know, referenced this in the book, and you know, if they had been best buddies and, you know, backslapping drinking buddies, you know, maybe the record wouldn't have turned out as you know, visceral as it did, you know, and to me, it just sounds real, you know, and sounds like anguish. So maybe that's the way it had to play out, you know, and I certainly have nothing but respect for a band for breaking up and never reforming. You know, you can't go wrong doing that, you know?
Yeah. So, it's a rare band that does not.
It's a rare band that does that. And I think Tim respected that too, because, you know, Operation Ivy broke up and never reformed. You know, they never went for the money and they were just like, you know, nope, that was then, this is now.
One of the things that we talked about a little bit ago, it relates to this and to Leftover Crack, is that the kind of situations and the level of drugs and like the fighting and this insanity of the bands, that was a lot more common in like rock and roll in the 60s and 70s and stuff, particularly 70s. But a band as big as Leftover Crack in the 2000s, I just don't feel like that kind of behavior existed. Like it's like times changed in a way. Like no one with money is going to deal with a band that difficult in the modern era is kind of like, I feel like was sort of the attitude. Like that was, I think the weirdest thing about the legacy of these two bands.
Yeah.
This is the time period of which they existed.
It shouldn't have happened. None of it should have happened. You're right. Especially in that period, right? It's like, it was not a safe bet. It was not like, you know, anybody that wanted anything to do with either of those bands was not, you know, placing their bets on selling a bunch of records.
I would add that, like in the book, the people in Epitaph talk about this, is they talk about how, you know, Leftover Crack, I mean, I think it's Choking Victim, that actually both Choking Victim and Leftover Crack show up, and they camp in like the Epitaph, like garden or whatever they have at Epitaph Records, and it freaks a lot of people out. And it's like, well, you know, we're used to kind of Fun in the Sun, board shorts kind of guys, you know, pop punk. And then here are these crusty crust punk guys that are like, they're for real deal. And I mean, I guess it was out of time in that the mid 90s, early 2000s, punk is exploding. Green Day's gigantic. Rancid's pretty big. You know, NoFX is pretty big. And so those bands are all great bands, but they're not crust punk. They're not, you know, self-destructive like Leftover Crack is. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why they did resonate with people so much, is that it is the real, like, one of the things that I was surprised about before I started the book, I thought a lot of the stuff about drugs and mental health, I thought it was true, but made a cartoon for the record, but it's all pretty much true. So I think that's what like attracted people to the band, is that this is the real deal. This is real punk. These are real crust punks, or I guess maybe not. I mean, the word crust punk is a very weighted term or heavy term. They're real. What they're singing about is real. They're genuine, and it's not some, you know, act, or they're not modified by any PR company. You know, they're not dressing the way a stylist has them dress. This is them. And I think that's why they were so effective with people. And so, sure, was that out of time with the punk era? Sure, this is an era when punk is getting even more pop punk. There's better production. Things sound smoother. And Leftover Crack comes along and is nasty sounding, as, you know, just nasty sounding. And so people are like, well, this is the real punk rock that I want. Not some people, you know, not the kind of filtered mainstream-ish type stuff that you might hear on the radio.
And it's like, I would say even the extent of the drugs, like, yeah, back in the 70s, you know, all entertainers did tons of drugs, and it was like celebrated. But I feel like people, you know, in the late 90s and on, it's like there was less and less. And I'm not like pro drugs, mind you, but like less drugs was put up with in the entertainment industry. And if you were doing drugs, you had to be like you had to be able to get your shit together and do your drugs and still be productive and not a pain in the ass.
I don't know if that was true for like a lot of rock stars. I don't want to name
names. In the 2000s? No, in the 2000s?
I listen, there are several very famous gigantic rock bands where the members are always fighting, and it's clear why. I don't want to name names because I don't want to be on the other end of a defamation suit. But that being said, this is important. All the members of the band that had experience with drugs felt, what about to say, they were very adamant about this, and we really tried to. The book does not say drugs are cool. And if you ask me, the book is kind of the biggest argument that drugs aren't cool. You know, you probably don't want to do them, you know. But I will say you have to commend all the members of the band, and they all really wanted to stress the point, we don't want to make drugs look cool, you know. And I think that was a danger, because drugs is a part of the band, you know, and the lyrics. And so we, as the band members insisted, we did really try to make sure that drugs, and we're not trying to teach a moral lesson necessarily, but we didn't want the message to be drugs are cool when you have fun on drugs. So we really didn't want that to be the message of the book. And I don't think it is.
No, I didn't catch the fun vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah. You know, I have to agree with John on that. I mean, it's, you know, when you were talking about, you know, people, you know, getting the impression of, you know, about the shock value and stuff. It's like, you know, maybe some of the artwork was goofy and the skits are goofy and, you know, some of the shit was really goofy. But, you know, there was no, I mean, you know, what you saw, what, you know, was what you got. And, you know, the convictions were there. You know, and the you know, the band was very serious about its political leanings, you know, and trying to effect a change, you know, and we would do, you know, you know, every, you know, it was like we would do the opposite of anything that a band would do to further their career or make themselves bigger, you know, or make more money or do better. It's like we were attracted to doing the polar opposite, you know, much to my dismay, you know, a lot of times, you know, but, you know, we would, you know, piss off shows that would pay a lot of money in favor of doing, you know, benefit shows, you know, you know, any way that we could be a part of, you know, of really trying to, you know, be positive in the midst of all this negativity, you know. And I think that, again, I didn't write the lyrics and, you know, I don't do drugs. I did them at one time. I did them for a long time. It ended, you know, for me, it was very catastrophic, you know, and there was no music, there was no bands, you know, there was no, it was a pretty bleak period, you know. So by the time that, you know, I resurfaced out of my coma in the early 90s, you know, the fact that you know, punk had become mainstream was totally new to me. What was I getting at? Oh, yeah. So, you know, I think that these guys were writing songs, not saying do drugs, everybody, but here's my experience of how this drug is saving me from killing myself, you know? And I know that there was a period for myself when I was very young, that maybe that, you know, they actually helped me get through a lot of tough times. You know, I had an escape hatch and it was drugs and alcohol, and it got me through some rough periods, but you know, that stuff eventually turns on you because that it has been doing that to humans since the dawn of man. You know what I mean? The drugs will always win, you know, you know, there's never a happy ending. So, you got to get out of it, you know, and, you know, I always encourage those guys to not take the drugs, you know, do not do the drugs, man. I've fucking been there and it's a one-way street, you know, but you can't make anybody do anything. You can't.
You know, addiction is a very, very complex thing. I know people who have pulled out of it, who put their entire being into overcoming it, and it took a long time. And I know people who have never overcome it, that just go in and out and in and out and in and out. They never overcome it. So
I do too. It takes everything. It has to take 100% of your energy. There can be nothing else. You know, that, I mean, that's my experience, is that it has to be the only thing, at least, you know, in the beginning. Right.
Yeah. I have a friend who was doing drugs. And I think he moved on to crack at one point until he hit like rock bottom. And his only option was his parents would said, yes, we'll take care of you, but you have to go into rehab. This 1 year rehab program, that's church thing too. And he's like, all right, you know, I'll do it. And he was telling me that, you know, it by the third or fourth month, he's finally at a place where he's like able to have thoughts about how he's, you know, he's the one that's making these decisions, that it's, he's not a victim. Like it takes that long of being off the drug to even start to have process the emotions behind the drugs, the responsibilities you have, that you make these decisions, that you take the drugs, that you're not a victim. You know what I mean? Like just getting to those emotions, like took him like 3 or 4 months of being off the drug, just processing, you know, going cold turkey, being in this program, being forced to constantly think about himself, think about his emotional state, you know, the reasons that lead to the drugs.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a personal choice, right? And, you know, lots of people have circumstances, you know, come from, you know, horrible backgrounds and horrible circumstances, and they're truly victims of circumstances, you know, but it's almost like a separate issue, you know, and drugs become become the solution, you know, to cope with that. But in the end, the drugs become, also the executioner. So, you know, you have to decide, you know, okay, do I want to work on coping with these, horrible things that happen to me, in a way that isn't so destructive? Do I want to live? And if I do, are there other ways to do it other than this, because it's not working anymore? I mean, that that was at least my experience, and some of my friends, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And yeah, I can understand that and have sympathy for that. And then if you're not an addict, I'm not an addict. It's hard to get into the mind frame of the addict, because it's not the same kind of mind. I think that's some of it too. It's a different kind of mind.
So they say.
So they say, yeah. So the first Leftover Crack album was supposed to be called Shoot the Kids at School. Let's talk a little about the story, then I want to get your take on this.
Sure.
Hellcat or Epitaph, whatever, said no to the title, which was an unusual thing in that they didn't typically censor artists. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, how did it go down?
Well, you know, I wasn't really there for all of that. I mean, I was kind of dividing my time between, being on the road with, you know, Rancid or other bands. And then I had my own band, as well. And so I was kind of getting, keeping abreast of it peripherally. And, to me, I was like, Shoot the Kids at School, that title's terrible. Yeah. You know, so when when I heard they didn't want to do it, I was like, oh, well, okay, you know. I think I don't know if Sturgeon told me, or if I just, you know, a CD was just, I was back at Hellcat one day, and you know, I saw the CD there, and it's like, Mediocre Generica, this is a fucking great name. Ah, this is so good, brilliant. You know, and I didn't even know the backstory to it, that Christina White is kind of, talking about it, in the book. And I knew that Sturgeon was very upset. And the band was very upset. I had left Leftover Crack at that point. You know, I did the first, handful of shows in LA with them. And then I moved to New York City for a while, and I played with them out there for a bit. And then, F Minus already had a record out, but we weren't really a band. We were just a theory. We weren't really a band. And I'd been talking to the other members, and it was like, well, you know, let's like, this offer for this tour came up. You guys want to do it? And, you know, so I moved back to California and left Leftover Crack for a period. I moved back to California and started, you know, getting busier with F Minus. And we ended up making, another record. And, you know, I was kind of lost in that world for a while. You know, we toured constantly. I heard about, I was there for a little bit of Mediocre Generica. I came in and did some guitar and some, backup vocals and stuff. But, the whole period, surrounding the name change and Epitaph not wanting to do that, I wasn't really there for.
Yeah, it was funny, like in the book, you know, it has all these different people talking about how like upset they were, that they felt like Epitaph betrayed them almost. And then your quotes are like, oh yeah, whatever. Who cares? Like, it's almost like, what's the big deal? Let's just move on.
Come on. You know? It's like, that's the price, that's the price of doing business. That's the price of collaborating, right? And it's the same in a band situation. It's like, you know, if you want to be in a band situation, you want to work with other people, and you want it to be, you know, the sum of its parts, you know, and this sort of greater thing, well, then you have to make concessions, you know, you don't have to, but that's the price of collaborating with people is, you know, considering, you know, what they may be willing or not willing to do. And I suppose I was in a unique position, and it's easy for me to say, because I worked there too, you know what I mean? And those guys didn't see it that way. They were just like, fuck these dicks, fuck Epitaph, you know, fuck Hellcat. And I understand that, you know, if I wasn't sort of a double agent, I guess, I may not have seen it that way. But, you know, working from, you know, both ways, you know, or being on both sides of it, I knew that the people at Hellcat and Epitaph, they didn't want to do that, you know. they didn't want to fucking do that. You know, they wanted to be known as the punk label that helped, you know, supports its artists and has fucking cool bands, you know, putting out all of this, like, you know, compelling shit. And it was a hard decision for him, you know, and Tim wasn't stoked about it. You know, Chris LaSalle, Wicks, none of those guys were like, oh, this is, oh, no, this just can't happen. You know, it wasn't like a, you know, that sort of, at least that was my take. I was friends with all those people too. You know, that the whole thing was like, you know, it was a weird period, man. It was a weird period to be putting out a record called that. And you know, the stuff that Christina talks about, I didn't even know about, you know, and you know, that they had a board meeting and I didn't know they were getting shit for Bad Religion and Pennywise and stuff. And it's like, oh, fuck. To me, it was just like, oh, that title sucks. Mediocre Generic is way better. Next.
Yeah, when I heard that story, it was funny to me because when in 2000, when Link 80 had wanted to put out an album, we'd wanted to call it Hella.
Yeah.
You know, because of the Bay Area slang, and Mike Park wouldn't have it. And it came out that Alkaline Trio was putting out the album that ended up being Maybe I'll Catch Fire at the same time. They share a release date, and they wanted to call that album Shitty. And so they had just told Mike they wanted to call their album Shitty, and then we told him we wanted to call our album Hella.
Oh my God.
And so he would have these two albums come out that would have been Hella Shitty.
Shitty. Yeah. So what did Mike say to you? He just said, no, I'm not fucking.
He said, no, change it. Call it something else, which wasn't a big deal to us. We were like, oh, damn, that sucks. But then we just came up with a different title.
Did you feel like you were being censored in any way or you're,
nope,
you were compromising your artistic integrity?
No, but I really do think it would have been funny if Maybe I'll Catch Fire was called Shitty.
I think that's a way better title, actually. But you know, I ran a label too out of my, you know, out of my house for a few years, and it, I came across that too. Like, you know, bands wanted to do, you know, some things, and I went with, you know, sure, let them do it, you know, fine, you know, and that was the path. That was the path I took. You know, I personally, you know, wasn't into it, but it's like, you know, it'll make them happy. Fucking go for it. But I, you know, I've been told, you know, I don't know. I haven't been told no in that sort of context, but I've been told many times no, you know, as far as in life, you know, and you just fucking get on with it.
I'm not going to say if I like one title more than the other. I think there's good arguments all around, and I think the book makes those arguments. But I will add, you know, from the perspective of the artist, Shoot the Kids at School, it's the title Shoot the Kids at School assumes that you're intelligent enough to realize they don't actually mean go shoot the kids at school, especially when you read the lyrics, when those aren't the lyrics. You should go shoot this kid at school. Those aren't the lyrics, you know. And so the album assumes the listener, and it compliments the listener, that you're intelligent to understand this concept and do something with it, rather than maybe a lot of other punk records or other records that are coming out at the same time that are, you should do X, you should do Y, you know, talk to people at the most basic of all level. And so when you have this concept that is kind of interesting or edgy, the artist can hold that very dear, you know, and maybe good art should make people uncomfortable. You know, Andy Warhol's art made people uncomfortable. Salvador Dali's art made people very uncomfortable, you know. And so when an artist has this concept that no one else has expressed and is has multiple levels and trust the listener, the fans, to say, you're intelligent enough, you understand what I'm saying, I'm expressing something that no one else out here has expressed because they don't have the courage to express it, and I'm going to express it. And then someone comes along and says, nope, too edgy, we want something safer. You can understand how that can affect the artist quite deeply. And so people go on both sides of this battle, which I think is interesting, but I wouldn't say one side is definitely the right side and one side is definitely the wrong side, if you will.
I agree with that. And I know, I mean, you know, in the band's defense, I know that you know, they believed, you know, Sturgeon believed very strongly in that title and he had reasons for it. You know, it was a line from the song, you know, Rock the 40 Ounce. And, you know, it was, you know, a social commentary, you know, about being bullied, you know, and it, to me, at least that was my take. And, you know, he didn't really mean go shoot kids at school, you know, and shoot teachers. And I think if that, you know, he had presented that title to him at another time, maybe, you know, a year before, it probably would have gotten, you know, they probably would have ran with it. You know what I mean? I think the timing was just, you know, looking at it now and you know, having talked to, you know, Charlie and Christina and you know, other people about it, it's like, oh yeah, they might have gone with that, you know, if it had happened just, you know, a little bit earlier. So yeah, I agree. I mean, with that too, art should push people to think, you know, and I don't think he was trying to be
cute. You know, it's not cute.
I don't think he was trying to be cute. No. I don't think he was trying to be shocking, like, oh, this will sell records. I don't think any of those things at all. He took it very seriously. And that's why he was crushed, you know.
I will add to Leftover Crack's credit, there have been many, many, many times where they could have made the easy choice for more money or the harder artistic choice for less money, and they always go for the artistic choice over the money choice.
And I'm sorry, Sturgeon, if you're listening and if I'm incorrect about any of this, your reasons behind any of these things,
yeah,
or your lyrics or anything, you know, I'm just speculating, you know, so I apologize, man, if I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. That's my take on it.
Was there any other, to your knowledge or while you were there, was there any other thing like this that happened at Epitaph where they had a board meeting and said, we cannot do this, or we are artists, this title or this song can't be on here?
That's a good question.
I'm just curious if this is an entirely unique thing or if this was like, you know.
I don't think it was an entirely unique thing. I don't. You know, they at the time, you know, they were such a big label that they were really, they had become sort of guarded, you know, because they were open to just getting, you know, attacked or lawsuited, or, you know, people are like, oh God, they have all this money, you know, and I know they're getting, you know, attacked on you know, in some ways. And so they were really careful about copyright infringement, you know, and any sort of art or sample, like, you know, DFL did that, did this, the DFL show cassette, and, they put out like 1,000 cassettes DFL was this like hardcore band on Epitaph in the, I don't know if you know, but it was like Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys and AWOL and some other guys from around
Monty Messix, baby.
Monty Messix, you know,
Crazy Tom.
Yes. I mean, that's right. And I thought they were great, you know? And so the DFL show, the cassette came out and it had all these samples on it and none of them were fucking cleared. None of them at all, man. It just had like, you know, and they didn't find out till they had already released like 1,000 of these cassettes and put them in stores. And it was like, wait a minute, you didn't fucking clear any of this shit? And they just shut it down immediately and, you know, tried to recall it. But, you know, as far as that went, but, so stuff like that would happen. You know what I mean? And I remember when, you know, I was doing stuff with my band, so then I just had to make sure that, you know, all the art was original and this kind of stuff. So, you know, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, that's interesting. That's interesting to hear that story. I didn't know about that.
About the DFL tape show?
About the having all the samples and getting recalled and all that. Yeah.
Oh, it's a fucking great tape too. If you can ever find it, it's, you know, they put on like, they're like, yeah, this Japanese band sent us a tape of them covering one of our songs and that's on there. You know, they just had all this like just fucking insane shit, you know. It was a piss take. None of it cleared. None of it okayed.
I was, I guess, a little surprised to see in the book when you guys are talking about the 9/11 and then the next album, how many people in the band were just started going off about the conspiracy, the inside job conspiracy.
Right.
Your answer though, I feel like you're saying there isn't an inside job, but you were being kind of nice about it.
I mean, you know, I don't know if there was or there wasn't, you know, it's like irrelevant really,
yeah.
You know, to me, it's like, you know, Yeah, so what if there was, you know, I don't care about that. I, you know, what I watched unfold was horrific, you know, and to me, it was like, I didn't care why this was happening, you know, and so maybe that's a real short-sighted, you know, attitude, you know, but I mean, you know, if it was a conspiracy by our government, it, you know, or an inside job, I mean, is that like a surprise to anybody? Like, oh fuck, that's shocking, you know, like, okay, maybe it was, you know, but what does that, you know, what does that have to do with, you know, the tragedy itself? And you know, I've been reading this book, this oral history, recently called, The Only Plane in the Sky, which is an oral history about, 9/11, and it interviews people that were like in the rubble, you know, that, you know, were in the offices, you know, in the fucking planes. It's like, it's just a mind blowing book. It really, it's a hard read, you know what I mean? And, so, you know, maybe there was a conspiracy, maybe it was an inside job. It's like, you know, that's like so commonplace, especially, you know, that's politics, man. That's government, you know, it's like, yeah. So, you know, what does that change about? What are we going to do about it? You know, how are we going to find out? It's like, who shot Kennedy? You know, well, we're never going to know. He got a fucking bullet in the head and he's dead, you know? And that's like, you know, and it happened on, you know, in front of the whole world, you know, to me, that's like, you know, I don't know. I'm not pro or con, you know, Robert Kennedy, but you know,
yeah,
I'm anti-violent, man. You know, I don't, you know, really, you know, it's like, it's like, I don't like that kind of stuff. I just don't. It's just very, you know, it's fucking tragic. So my attitude on it was, you know, I'm not even going to go there, and I'm not going to jump down. I'm not a conspiracy guy. You know, I'm just not one of those people.
I am very not a conspiracy guy either. The inside job one always surprises me. People who are not super conspiracy-ish, I seem to get into that one. And it always surprises me when I hear that.
To me, I don't think it was. It's fucking warfare, you know. And yeah, so I mean, that's how it looked to me.
Yeah, and it's like ineptitude, I think, you know. That's the thing, you know.
Yeah, it's warfare, and war is fucking garbage, you know.
In 2001, this album comes out, and you know, the real heyday of, you know, what people want to call third wave ska had died a couple years previously, and here's this band still chugging along, you know, with ska elements mixed in with their music. How was that part of the band perceived during that time period?
You know, I don't think anybody ever thought of us as a ska band, you know. I, at least, you know, that's not the impression I got. I don't know if we ever counted as a you know, a real ska band. I know that Sturgeon was really into, you know, going to ska shows. You know, he was in that scene in New York City, you know, with the whole Moon Ska, you know, and you know, all of those bands, of which I know very little about. I know he was really about that, you know, and he went to all those shows and you know, he mingled with all of those people and you know, introduced me to a lot of them. But I don't think it was perceived as you know, I don't think that ska bands took us seriously as a ska band. You know what I mean? I certainly, you know, never thought of the band as being a ska band. And for a lot of years, I couldn't play ska, you know, I would not play on those parts. Right.
Oh really?
Yeah. Wow. I would not play. I would just stand.
What would you do?
I would stand there, you know, like the dancing guy from the Boston's, or you know, whatever, you know, and sorry to the dancing guy from the Boston's. I mean, you know, I would just, you know, no diss on him, right? And you know, I would just not play, or I would do like a, you know, you know, kind of thing. But a few years into it, I'm like, you know, hey, I feel really like you know, ridiculous standing there not playing. You know, you guys want to teach me how to play that, you know, because I knew how to play, you know, when hardcore guys or metal guys try and play ska, it's just always just a fucking tragedy, right? You know, it's just stiff.
Sure.
It's so stiff. And that's how I played ska. You know, like, yeah, I heard some Clash records, you know, let me show you, you know, and you know, Ezra and Sturgeon were like, no. You know, here's how you do it. And you know, it's percussive, you know, you got to fucking loosen up, relax. You know, it's like a, you know, it's like playing a drum, you know what I mean? It's like, it's not like, you know, I had to approach it, not like a guitar. Right. And so, you know, they worked on me, you know, I don't know if I'm any better at playing it, you know, certainly I guess better at playing it now than I was. But I understand the concept, you know, and I, you know, I would see reggae bands and watch how those guys played, and they were, you know, it was just very, it was less deliberate, you know, than just fucking hitting a bar chord. And, you know, it's really a very, you know, it's very subtle, and I love the sound of it. I do. I really do. You know, to hear a person, you know, a good ska guitar player that can really play ska is like, yeah, man, that's like it's a talent, you know, it takes skill, you know, you just can't, at least that's my opinion, you know?
Yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah. And I've seen, you know, many a metal guy, you know, like, okay, many a hardcore guy, here's the ska breakdown. And it's just, you know, it's just not that easy. And I'm not a ska guy. Not that I'm an authority on playing ska, but, you know, they really worked on me to, but no, you're only hitting two strings, buddy. You know, two strings. Play here on the, play with your right hand on the neck, you know, it'll help.
It's a strange thing with ska. Usually a band that has a little bit of ska is basically a ska band and is basically embraced by the ska people. And the non-ska people go, that's a ska band, even if like 10% of the band's music is ska, right? That's the weird thing about ska. But you guys were definitely an exception to that. Like, I feel like you were more considered like a crust punk band than anything else, you know? That was the thing that you were mostly, and then you did stuff. You did other stuff too.
Right. Like, let me ask you, what do you consider Citizen Fish?
Me personally, I say ska or ska punk or whatever. You know, I mean, I guess the Citizen Fish is another band that is, you know, definitely in that category. But, you know, in my mind, I consider them in the ska category.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I never thought of Citizen Fish as a ska. Because the ska band, majority of their music is ska music, and you know, maybe it's you know, because of the Subhumans connection, or you know, I don't know, but they're a very good band.
But they were, you know, them and was the band before them was Culture Shock.
Yeah. Culture Shock,
yeah,
Culture Shock, baby.
Yeah, we're talking about like ska punk, you know, that predates Op Ivy, you know, that.
Yes.
You know, so they're a very significant band that don't really get their due as much as they deserve it.
I agree. I totally agree. They have some great, great songs. Really great songs.
Plus, Dick Lucas is a delightful person.
Oh, Dick Lucas is the man. Yeah.
Dick is the man.
Yeah.
So doing these interviews, like the interviewees felt like very honest, and it didn't always feel like everyone had good feelings towards other people, you know, like it didn't feel like everyone had all healed and now they're telling stories necessarily. I don't know what the reality is, but
yeah.
Was it a challenging experience to go through these histories that may have not really been, you know, maybe everyone's not cool with everybody, but we're still digging up this history. What was that experience like for you guys?
I mean, I think that's the book's strongest asset, honestly. The book is not rah, 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 Leftover Crack is the best band ever, and everyone loves them. And they, you know, formed, broke up, and got back together, and it was the best time ever. You know, that's not the book. The book is a very honest take on Leftover Crack. The fantastic highs and then the low lows. And I think Leftover Crack has both. So the funniest thing was when interviewing people, a lot of people have very different perspectives on things and very different memories on things. And we instead of trying to figure out what the truth was, because you never will, we just put them both in there and let people disagree. And if anything, I wouldn't say that was difficult, because it seemed like for the most part, people were ready to unload. You know, here's why I hate Brad Logan, which isn't in the book because everyone loves Brad Logan, you know, but that kind of thing, you know. And I will say, pretty much everybody was a good sport about it. Like we ran it past everybody. Everybody was a good sport and say, well, I don't like this guy or I don't like that guy. But also, I think more than anything, there's very few people in the book that says, I hate Leftover Crack or I love Leftover Crack. People have very mixed emotions about the band. Bill Cashman, an early Leftover Crack manager, members of Leftover Crack.
Bill Cashman was the first Leftover Crack fan.
Fan, I'm sorry, not
ever.
Manager.
In the beginning, yeah. There was Bill Cashman. I'm sorry, continue.
Even other musicians like even Dick Lucas, you know, has mixed emotions on the band, and well, I don't want to put any words in his mouth. Penny Rimbaud of Crass has mixed opinions of the band, you know. And so I forgot exactly where I was going with this, but the point was that wasn't difficult. Honestly, that was one of the most interesting things, and I think that's one of the things that really makes the book good, is there are different opinions, and it is as an objective view of the band as we could make it be, without saying rah 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 Leftover Crack is the best, but also not like Motley Crue, where like here's all the bad things they did. You know, we tried to give an honest portrayal of the band.
So I mean, for a lot of people, it was cathartic to say all their like grievances, to air their grievances, basically,
It's not just grievances though. I mean, let's not paint as strictly negative. A lot of people have a lot of really nice things to say about the band. Dick Lucas, Bill Cashman, you know, people have negative things, also say positive. So, I mean, the book isn't all doom and gloom. I don't want the listeners to think that.
No, I didn't mean it like that. I just meant like, was it a, you know, what I was getting at is like, you know, there's a lot of like sore spots to go over, and was like that.
Well, sure. I mean, it's a band called Leftover Crack, you know,
I mean, like interpersonal issues is what I'm saying, like interpersonal, and like people were anxious to talk about it. And it sounds like people were anxious to get it off their chest, you know, like
I would say so,
versus like, oh God, I do not want to relive that stuff, or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there were some people, I guess, that didn't want to talk too much, you know, and so we said, all right, well, what do you want to say? And they said what they want to say, and that was that. But for the most part, people were anxious to say about the great fun they had with the band. And one of the most fun part of the books is the donut social where Ed Sturgeon and Chris of Team Spider run from the cops, you know, and so they're having a lot of fun there. And so... we didn't really have to like really squeeze anybody. People just kind of showed up and said, here's the story, here's the fun parts, here's the not fun parts.
You know, when I approached people to do these, you know, I knew specifically the incidents and the you know, I knew the things that I wanted to talk about. And people were like, you know, hey, you know, I don't know if I should say this and that. And I wanted them to understand that they were free to say exactly what was on their mind and exactly how they felt, that this wasn't going to be a press release, you know, and paint the band and, you know, any one way or the other. I wanted it to be, you know, a mix, you know, what I feel the band is just a mixture of so many things, you know, positive, negative. So I let people, you know, and John did too. I mean, we just let them cut loose and say what they had to say. You know, and I hope it's reflected in the book that way, you know, and I think that's the key. I know that the oral histories that are my favorite, that I really like to read, and really that's my favorite, you know, sort of format for, you know, reading about, you know, not only a band, but, you know, like the Edie Sedgwick, you know, and then this one I was telling you about 9/11, it's great because it gives you so many perspectives, you know, and you know, it's up to the reader to decide, you know, what perspective is what happened, really, you know, how did this play out, you know, or if somebody had, you know, negative feelings, it's like, say them. Yes. Fucking speak, state.
I appreciated that about the book. I appreciated the contradictions, the honesty, just getting it out there. I mean, I love reading like oral history where it's like person A says this, and then person B says something that's like a completely different point of view about what happened.
Right? Because isn't that what a discussion, you know, you're having a discussion with 10 of your friends. Isn't that how that goes down? You know? Yeah.
So our friend Brent Friedman, who's, I know, Brad, you know him.
Brent yes. Friedman. Yes.
I have a Brent question. Well, so he told me that what was it? The secret leftover crack Jesse Michaels show. So you tapped him to book that. I want to hear a little bit more about this show, kind of behind the scenes of that.
So he said, ask about the Bridgetown DIY show that he booked.
No, he didn't ask me to. I just know that he told me that you tapped him to book that show. And to him, it's like a really special memory. So, it was amazing footage. I mean, I wasn't there, but I saw the footage. So I'm just curious a little bit, just anything you want to say about that show or just kind of putting that thing together. Because everyone who's seen it has just flipped out, you know, Jesse Michaels playing with you guys, doing Op Ivy songs and all that.
I think I probably ran into, you know, Brent at our local grocery store
he says that he's seen you at multiple grocery stores, by the
That's
way.
Kind of our thing, right? That's where we'll, you know, we'll meet and we'll discuss, you know, we'll solve the world's problems, you know, and at the checkout, you know, at the self-checkout. So, yeah, I think I probably ran into him and said, you know, hey, you know, we want to do the show. And, I think we were doing a video too, maybe. I can't remember. I don't know if we did a video or not. But, hey, do you know anywhere we could play? And it was kind of last minute. And he's like, yep, I'm going to talk to this place, Bridgetown DIY, which is in El Monte and a great space, you know. And so he set up the show, and Where the Union opened. And so it was us and them. And it was funny. I mean, it was like, you know, we were, you know, we knew we were going to, we had talked, Jesse into doing some Op Ivy songs reluctantly with us, you know, and I think, you know, Sturgeon talks about it in the book for a little bit, you know, he wasn't like, you know, that sounds like a great idea. He was like, all right. You know, you know, we kind of trapped him, you know, into doing it. But it was a big deal for us, you know,
it's not like he does that often. So it was a pretty amazing thing to have pulled
he
off.
He doesn't do that often. No, yeah. At all. So we were honored. Really, we were. And, you know, we played. The funny thing is there was only probably 50 people there, you know, you know, it was pissing rain outside, you know, on a weeknight. And it, you know, it never rains here. Right. It was pissing rain. So plus this club is like super hard to get to. It's like, you know, not easy access, not by the freeway. You have to get off the freeway and drive through like neighborhood after neighborhood. And finally, it's like a, you know, just this little storefront strip mall, basically. So there was just the right amount of people there, you know, it wasn't packed out and everybody got to get crazy and have fun. And it was just so cool, you know. It was just it was really low key and a lot of fun.
The footage, like, and I just can imagine being there. Everyone seems like they turned into a the 14-year-old selves. Just like
we all lost our shit when Jesse started singing with us. We did, right? It's like we played our set and it was like, yeah, big fucking deal. But when Jesse came out and did those Op Ivy songs with us, it was like everybody lost their shit, you know, us included. It's like, are we really doing this? You know, I remember that going through my mind. Are we really doing this? This is really happening.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you haven't already, subscribe to my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get episodes of the In Defense of Ska podcast and other content sent directly to your inbox. If you would like to order my book, In Defense of Ska, you can go to Amazon, request it at your favorite indie bookstore or library, or go to clashbooks.com.
And on that note, we leave you by saying, ska now more than ever. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.